Started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Melbourne Business School. I'm David Frankel, the organizer of today's two panel discussions. I'll start by acknowledging the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, the traditional custodians of this land, as well as paying my respects to their elders, past, present, and emerging. Our first panel will focus on the monetary policy lessons that we've learned during the pandemic and its aftermath. Our chair is Professor Chris Edmond, professor of economics at Melbourne University, and a fellow of the Econometric Society and the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. In alphabetical order, our first panelist is Michelle Bullock, Deputy Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia. Also with us is Begonia Dominguez, Professor of Economics at the University of Queensland, Ian Harper, Dean of Melbourne Business School and a member of the RBA Board of Governors, and Greg Kaplan, Professor of Economics at the University of Chicago. So without any further ado, I give you Professor Chris Edmond.
Thank you, David. So, and thank you, everyone, for attending this panel. So the goal of the panel discussion today is about sort of monetary policy and what we can learn from the pandemic. But I thought it would be useful to start with a slightly backwards-looking focus, just kind of taking us back to those heady days of 2018, 2019, when life was still perfect or close to it, and ask... I'm going to start with Ian and ask, why was the RBA doing such a bad job of hitting its inflation target in those heady days? So life was tranquil, and yet the RBA was systematically undershooting the inflation target. What combination of factors do we think was causing that?
I think like a leading question. Thank you, Chris. They were intriguing days. I've been on the bank board since 2016, and subject to being corrected by my colleague, we went through that period where we didn't move the rate for a very lengthy period of time. Notwithstanding, as Chris has said, that the inflation outcome was consistently below our target range, which is 2 to 3% on average over the cycle, says the target in the agreement with the government. I think there were two factors going on, Chris, as I look back over that period myself. The first is that there was a great deal of uncertainty, and there still is in a way, as to what the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment was. We figured that it was somewhere close to where we were, but we weren't absolutely certain where it was. And I think I'd emphasize in this audience, Chris, that we're talking about non-accelerating inflation. So we were concerned, given the history of inflation in this country, and not knowing quite where that was in the fog, that if we were to stimulate the economy more than we were doing, there was a danger that unemployment would fall below that level, a level which we couldn't see, and then inflation wouldn't just go up, it would become accelerating. Right? Now, with hindsight, with the benefit of hindsight, obviously we were well above what we would now accept to be the non-accelerating rate of inflation rate of unemployment, as a result of which it looks like we did a terrible job. When you look backwards, oftentimes, of course, you see things much more clearly than you do at the time. That was one factor. The second factor was that there was a significant build-up in household debt, primarily as a result of rising house prices, people borrowing a lot of money to get into the housing market. And household debt, which is still very high, was growing quite rapidly. Now, not every central bank in the world also has a responsibility to look to financial stability, but the Reserve Bank of Australia does. So there's a monetary policy target to be looked at, and there are concerns about financial stability. I would emphasize that the argument I've just put about the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, I would argue, was the dominant argument or dominant reason. But financial stability is never far behind. And both of those things led us to be extremely cautious, with hindsight, excessively cautious in how we set interest rates during that time. That would be my answer.
Michelle, would you agree with that?
I wasn't on the board at the time, but I would agree. I was actually in the financial stability part of the bank at the time, and we did used to have a little bit of a discussion about that particular issue. And there was two camps, I think, in that. One was that don't lower interest rates too much because you might inflate debt more. The other side of the argument was just lower them as much as you like and use macroprudential tools to make sure that you clamp down on debt. So, but I think the dominant view, and consensus. I wasn't on the board, but the view was that just be a bit more cautious on the way down to protect against that financial stability risk.
You think it's a problem that, you know, so we can kind of have a specific numerical understanding of the inflation target and whether the bank is or isn't sort of delivering that inflation target. But then when you invoke financial stability, there's much less clear like what it means in practice to be delivering or not delivering financial stability. So already in this conversation, there's been sort of several different sort of potential indicators referenced, so household indebtedness and other things of that kind. So like, how should we think about like that, if you like, that asymmetry of those potential objectives, putting aside just for the moment like a broader discussion of whether it makes sense to have multiple objectives given the limited number of instruments at hand. But just supposing one is to take financial stability seriously as a guiding sort of, you know, as an objective, how do you feel about like that lack of specificity?
I think it's the way I would think about it is that the target, Ian expressed it well, I think the target remains inflation. Unemployment is also in there. Financial stability is a background consideration that I think we just need to take into account. So I don't think it matters that we don't have a really specific measure of financial stability. It's actually very difficult to explain what financial stability is. It's easier to explain what financial instability is than it is to explain financial stability is, in my view. Really, I think it's a background consideration, but I wouldn't say we are using interest rates to dial up and back on financial stability. It's really about vulnerabilities building. And as we've seen in the global financial crisis, and we've seen a little bit recently, financial vulnerabilities build up, and then there might be a shock that results in those vulnerabilities generating financial instability. But financial stability of itself, I don't think you can actually sort of say, well, I've dialed it up, I've dialed it down. That would be my response.
So, Greg, I was going to ask if, you know, do you think then that the RBA should be sort of attempting to take financial stability more seriously? So I guess a kind of a response to that might be, and I'm going to ask Greg to kind of comment on this, is that the difficulty with that line of argument is that it puts the financial stability as a consideration in this sort of catch-all position that can be invoked or not invoked, a little bit like the sort of the checklist approach to monetary policy back in the late 80s, where it's like sometimes it's a significant consideration, other times it sort of is taking a backseat to sort of the more mandated inflation and unemployment objective. So Greg, I guess my question would be, should we be sort of thinking about ways to operationalize this, you know, so that we kind of not in that position of kind of using it as an argument of convenience, but instead have a kind of a more of a sense of when to invoke it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a great question. It's a difficult one to grapple with. I would say that the starting point is to accept and embrace that monetary policy is a very, very narrow set of instruments, and whether we like it or not, I mean, we can legislate all we like about what the bank should do, but each time you change a policy setting, you have impacts on, we hope, inflation, we hope, employment, certainly on financial stability, and certainly on distributional considerations as well. It would be wonderful if we had a tool that could pinpoint one of those. Coming back to that question of, you know, where was the RBA in 2020, between 2016 and 2019, I think a lot of what was going on at that time was almost an over-consideration of those core concepts that, you know, a lot of the criticisms that we saw were that the central bank was undershooting its inflation target. And now that seems to be, I think the one place we will agree is that we think that if the central bank can do anything, it can impact inflation. And we could talk about under what circumstances can that generate real effects on the economy. And one thing we saw then is that monetary policy settings were very loose at that time, and the discussion was, should they be even looser? And I think that is, I actually think that, you know, I was one of the people at the time saying, no, I don't think that they should be looser, because yes, we are understating a target, but we can legislate all we want. There's limits to what we could actually achieve.
It might be worth just adding too, I think, that undershooting the target and low wages growth and the idea that we might have overestimated the non-accelerating. This wasn't just an Australian issue. This was going on abroad as well. A lot of central banks were undershooting their targets. They were overestimating underestimating the degree of slack in the labour market. And I think, as Ian mentioned, has been borne out now. We could have had unemployment rate going down much further without putting a lot of pressure on wages, but we didn't know that at the time. We we weren't the only ones. Others were experiencing the same thing.
Right, so I want to bring Begonia in here. So I'm going to cannibalise the question a little bit. And so does that mean, Begonia, perhaps that central banks around the world, it seems like there was something of a common set of circumstances and a kind of perhaps a common conceptual framework in mind. And so it kind of leads one to wonder whether there was too much of a reliance and a kind of mechanistic relationship between inflation and or wage growth and the level of unemployment. And so I'm like wondering whether you think that there was too much reliance on that sort of that mode of thinking. Yeah, is there a stable Phillips curve?
Well, it seems it's not.
Well. All right.
Well, can I comment?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I think I think we need to call out the myth of the exploitable Phillips curve for what it is. It is a myth, and I think we'll talk about this. But one thing that we're looking at right now is more and more evidence that such a thing doesn't exist. But if we go back to 2019, most of the criticisms of the RBA were coming from a perspective that, hang on, if we're undershooting our inflation target, that means we're missing out on some candy to be had. We could have employment, the labor market could be doing even better than it already is. And I think that sort of thinking comes from an over-reliance on this idea of an exploitable Phillips curve that's not really there in reality.
I'm going to push back on that. So say that, I'm sure that there are people that had that view, but I think there's like well-founded reasons to take kind of inflation and or price dispersion seriously as a source of welfare losses, even if you put aside the unemployment consideration. So there are reasons to think that there are welfare losses with undershooting the target absent that labour market side of things. But I take your point.
I'd push back on that. It's hard to. It's certainly the cost of inflation that we're seeing now at 5% inflation over and above whatever they have on the direct real effects are there and different to being at 2%.
Yeah.
But to argue that there's significantly different welfare losses from being at 1% versus 2% in that direction is sort of a hard argument to make without a Phillips curve in the background.
Yeah, and especially if your concern is that you could accelerate it quickly, not just back to the target but out the other side.
Yeah. Right? Like I said, it's hard to get a little bit pregnant.
Correct.
The risk of deflation in Australia has been pretty low, but I don't think they, in Europe and in other places, they would see it a little bit more.
Yeah. Mm. All right. Well, this panel is supposed to be looking forward, so I want to I want to spend a little bit of time sort of transitioning to looking forward, and that's to talk about monetary policy during the pandemic itself. So I guess in kind of crude terms, so Begonia, with hindsight, to kind of take Ian's favourite word at the moment, with hindsight, do we think that monetary policy was too expansionary during the critical phases of the pandemic itself, say in 2020?
I think so. From an ex-ante perspective, probably it was the right thing to do. We were hit by a very big shock, negative shock, and we didn't know when we would be recovering from it. It actually, we recovered pretty quickly, and it took us by surprise, and inflation started picking up in 2021. And I think at that point, central banks responded a little bit too late, in my view. Most central banks around the world didn't respond until 2022, when we were seeing measures of inflation that haven't seen for 30 years. And when we look at the RBA, the RBA was actually one of the last to respond to the increase in inflation. We didn't stop the bond purchasing program until February 2022, and the first hike in interest rates was in May, when inflation was already at 5%. And that brings me to two questions. Should the should have central banks responded earlier, and by how much? And my view is that they should have responded a bit earlier, maybe 6 months. It was clear by the middle of 2021 that we were on our way out. Measures of inflation and expectations of inflation were rising and becoming more skewed. So I think we should have responded maybe 6 months earlier or so. Now, by how much? I think maybe we could have increased the interest rates earlier, but offsetting all these shocks is probably undesirable because it would have been taking the economy to a very big recession.
So, Michelle, do you kind of agree that perhaps I'll say the analysis maybe in a slightly different language that perhaps there was sort of too much emphasis given to like the adverse demand side effects of the pandemic and not enough to thinking of this as essentially a supply side phenomenon, and that in light of it being essentially a supply side phenomenon, that the bounce back in the real economy could be quite quick, and that sort of stimulus measures that were put in place in early 2020 may then have been sort of ex post proved to be unnecessary.
Look, I think again with hindsight, I think what we underestimated was the power of fiscal policy and monetary policy, not just here but around the world, all pushing in one direction. This was unprecedented,
sure.
You know, and I think people forget that, you know, we had shots of morgues in the streets in New York and Italy, and, it was shocking stuff. We were worried about the potential for people to lose their jobs and never get them back again, basically to end up with a really big structural unemployment problem. So I think what we did, and I think what others did, was the United States is a really good example. We completely threw everything at it, and we relied on the ability that with monetary policy, I think we could respond quickly. Question about whether or not we responded quickly enough. So I think there was a bit of an underestimation of that. To the points Begonia was making about we should have responded earlier, I think you've got to remember, too, that we came out of our sort of lockdowns and so on later than everyone else. So we were observing inflation happening overseas, and everyone was of the view transitory was the word of the day. Everyone was talking about it's transitory, it's supply chain issues to do with the pandemic. They got Russia's invasion of Ukraine on top of that. So we had these two massive supply shocks, and I think there was a sort of a feeling that this was going to be transitory. What people hadn't taken into account, I think, as well as we could have, was that there was a big demand element to it, and we're seeing that now. And that's why I think we're all behind the eight ball. Mm. So, yes, in a sense, I think you could say that we threw too much at it, but we were in completely uncharted territory, is what I would say.
We also had a much larger labour market response here in Australia, but a much higher labour force participation rate, and therefore much less action on wages than was occurring in the United States, for example.
Yeah.
So there were sort of no signs of inflation either in the labour market or elsewhere while we waited. Mm. And then, yeah, sure, come round the corner.
Can I add a couple of things, please. So I think the points about fiscal policy are really important. And supply side shock, yes, but we issued a tremendous amount of nominal liabilities. That if you just do the simplest monetarist arithmetic on it, will tell you that we should see something like a 15 to 20% increase in the price level if nothing else was changing. Now, other things did change, but just as a basic level. So that's sort of my apology for the RBA. So yeah, I'm on the somehow sort of out of central bank's control. Regardless of what one would have done, that's got to show up somewhere, right? Now, be less nice. I mean, I think that the concern really is not so much the delayed reaction, but the unconditional guidance that was given prior. So, and I think this ties into that discussion about Phillips curves and the critiques that were coming early on. I mean, my view is that it's irresponsible to be giving unconditional guidance so far out in the future, and it's even more, I think, unjustified then to hold on to that for so long once a shock did hit. It is one thing to say that it's not the central bank's job to be to be giving unconditional forecasts in the sense that they give, you know, there's lots of things that might happen, and it should be expected that as those things unfold, we will respond to those in appropriate ways. The language that was sequentially rolled out in the, over that period that we're talking about sort of unwound that in the public's perception, that we went away from unconditional forecasts to actual is exactly what we're going to do. And I think that put the bank in a difficult position relative to other countries. And what Michelle said is absolutely right, that things played out slower in Australia, but we printed the money at the same time. And I think there was a lot of reasons to expect that we would see exactly what we've seen right now.
Do you want to comment on whether it was unconditional?
Well, I will comment because I don't actually agree that it was unconditional. We were always conditioning it on the state, and there was a time bit, and we don't expect that we will reach that state until 2024. What I will accept, and we've said this in our review of forward guidance, was that the message got garbled.
And
I think it got garbled for two reasons. One was that the media and people latch onto a date. They latch onto a date much more easier. And what's really interesting is even now, while we're raising interest rates, they still want us to put a date on when we're going to stop doing it. People are clamouring for a date. They just want one. So we should have resisted, I guess, a little bit more there. So that was one reason. The second reason that I think we didn't get the message across really well is we talked around the sorts of things that we thought were going to be important, and we got a little bit fixated on wages.
Right.
And the review makes this point as well, that instead of focusing on saying we want to get inflation back in target and leaving it at that, we actually went on to say and will therefore be expecting this to happen to wages and you know this to happen on demand. And
yep.
So we muddied the communication, I think, and so we didn't do as well as we could have there. So I would say no, we didn't offer unconditional guidance at all. But I will do a mea culpa in terms of
yeah. Yeah, your subsequent words in the public's perception are very important.
And I grant that it was perceived in that way. I mean, I think there was something interesting on wages as well, which I'll just add to that, which is we did have a big supply shock. What is a big supply shock? It is a reduction in real wages, which is the level of nominal wage growth relative to the level of price growth. And so we should have expected to see a slowdown in nominal wage growth relative to nominal price growth relative to what we were expecting previously. So I think that's yet another reason why that overemphasis on the slow growth in nominal wages was indicative of a stance of on the demand side, perhaps not.
So I want to come back to this kind of question of like whether the kind of the RBA could have done a better job of kind of communicating some of the subtleties in sort of like time-dependent versus state-dependent policy. So Begonia, I want to bring you back in here. So like how, I mean, you know, one might think that it's a little bit too difficult to say to kind of like a lay audience that, you know, you haven't understood our complicated messaging. In some sense, it's sort of like, it feels like the institution that is, you know, the locus of expertise in this space has a kind of, in some sense, an obligation, I think, to provide like an education about what its language means. And so, whereas I think that what we see from the RBA is perhaps a little bit more, its communication tends to be a little bit more standoffish, not actually teaching the public what its language means. And so do you think there's like a role, like how would you kind of imagine or how could an institution like a central bank educate like the recipients of its communications about what that language means without sort of undermining sort of the message as such?
That's a tough question. Also, I see what Michelle is saying because the journalists are going to try. No, we want to know the date.
Right. But so what exactly? So we don't want to take for granted that journalists are always going to want a simplification. But it's the role of experts to guide people in informing expectations. So, like, if you're a criminal and your lawyer says, and says, I want to get off, and the lawyer says, well, you're not going to get off. This is the situation. It's the job of the lawyer in that sense to provide like realistic expectations and guidance as to the situation you're in.
Yes, and you need to be able to kind of communicate the model that you have in your mind of how you are going to be implementing that policy. No, so if you think that the right variable that you are going to be paying attention is wage growth or whether it is unemployment, or you want to have a look at vacancies, or so you want you don't want to muddy the waters, but you want to be able to say it in a way in which make that state contingent clear.
I'll try and ask a sort of similar question with like different language. So when do you think the RBA realized that the communication on this front was not working, that people were misunderstanding the policy? Like at what point was that clear to internal policymakers?
I think it was starting to become clear at the beginning of 2022 when we were...
But as late as that?
I think it was, yeah. Ian might have a different view because I sort of joined the board sort of April 2022, and I thought it was starting to become clear then that there was a lot of emphasis being put on the date.
Yes.
I think you've got to remember too that this was one part of a package of things that are done. Lowered the interest rate to 0.1%, the yield curve target, which was the other thing challenging. Which was also sort of a three-year target, which was the 2024 date. There was the TFF, which was also three-year funding. So all these things were sort of self-reinforcing. And I think that was part of the challenge of the whole thing, was that even though it was a state-based forward guidance, there was all these other things in place which gave...
The same sort of date.
Same date.
No.
On it. So this
reinforced it.
Reinforced it.
So I guess the question in some sense... Oh, so great, jump in, please.
I just wanted to finish your thought. I had a question related around forward guidance and around this discussion, but...
Well, I guess my question was just going to be like then... So suppose that we accept that there was some point that the bank sort of recognised that there was too much focus on the date, that there was a misapprehension had developed for whatever reason about the meaning of that date in that communication. So then... suppose that one, stipulate that that's the case. Is it obvious then that the right thing to do is not to try and correct that misapprehension and say, look, we try and provide some additional messaging around that and to kind of try and build up again a sense of like education or understanding in the public's mind?
Well, I think
that happened.
Yes, yeah, happen.
Right. I think I'm not telling tales out of school here. By
Please
point,
tell tales
well,
out.
Well, put it this way, right? The governor was asked by the 7:30 report, which is a quite widely seen current affairs program on our public broadcaster here in this country, and there was significant debate at the board as to whether or not the governor should appear.
Okay.
Right? For two reasons. One, because it was highly likely that the interviewer would be hostile and seek to twist the governor's words against the interests of the bank. The other faction on the board said... really your argument, right? Here's an opportunity for you, the governor, to now explain the subtleties of this to what is a sophisticated audience. This is the public broadcaster, so a lot of people who do think through the issues would watch this, right? And in the end, the governor decided to do it, and it turned out to be, I think, an exceptional performance on Philip's part, if I may say so. So, Chris, the notion that the bank sat there like the proverbial deer caught in the headlights and not wanting to do anything, that's false, right? Whether or not the governor's attempts in speeches and interviews were successful in allaying that impression, that's another matter.
And he was softening the language on the time-based through that period.
True.
So, we were trying to get the message across, but our traditional methods of communication use the financial press, for better or worse, speeches, interpretations of those. Is there a way we can get more to the people that we want to get to without going through that layer, that filtering layer, I think it's a really good question, and I think something that we'll be thinking about. We have our speeches program. We have a school sort of university education sort of program. Mm-hmm. But what about this other group of people that we really want to try and educate? How do we get to them? And I'm not sure that's easy, but I think we've got to try and think about it.
Greg, you had a point that you were going
to... Well, I was just wondering, given the audience here, whether it might be a good time to talk about what the role of this guidance is in the first place.
Yeah.
And maybe to sort of kick off that discussion, I think there's broadly speaking two sorts of objectives. It would be good to hear this from the bank's perspective. One is that one thing the bank doesn't want to do is create unnecessary volatility in financial markets, destabilize the financial system, and providing guidance on what price relative prices are going to look like in those markets is important to that extent. You don't want to be continually surprising market participants. And I'll put in that broad class as well what ended up being interpreted, which is you're going out to buy a house and what can I expect in terms of my mortgage payments, because at the end of the day, that is where the transmission's happening. Excuse me.
I find these chairs very difficult.
I have short legs.
Don't tip me off, please.
Yeah. I won't take
you don't want to kind of cast
I won't take you down.
No run of bank chair failures.
But there's sort of a second reason as well, which is less spoken about, but I actually think is there without being spoken, which is when interest rates got really low after 2008, banks around the world started turning to forward guidance as a stimulatory policy. And it's not without coincidence that the time of these discussions we're having about the nature of the guidance, the nature of what those statements were having to go on the 730 report, if it was just about stability, we should be doing that. That would be happening all the time. But it happens at this period of really low rates. And what's going on there is this idea that it's an additional source of stimulus. My own view, and I think that of an objective outsider who came down from Mars and looked at the evidence on this.
Chicago is not Mars, but anyway.
That will be even. This is the view of, I think, of an objective outsider that came down from Mars. Same with the Phillips curve, by the way, is that at best there's no evidence either way that this has any effect. At worst, maybe, you know, at best, nothing. So it'd be good to get the thoughts on you know, what do we think is the primary motivations, and how do we reconcile these two motivations for giving guidance in this way?
So can I just summarize that? So there's one motivation is stability, and the other is like using kind of forward guidance as sort of a statement about the expected path of future short-term rates.
Stimulus.
As stimulus through long-term rates.
Correct. Well, we can talk
partly
about
that. Yeah.
That may or may not be a transmission mechanism, but the announcements of future short-term rates having some stimulatory effect on the
economy. Right, yeah.
I would add a third one, which is the credibility of the central bank. If you follow with that, you are also strengthening the reputation.
Yeah, well, certainly as I recall, the idea was to try to encourage people to see through to the other side, right, of what was a massive dislocation. And the expression I think that Philip Lowe, the governor, used at the time was building a bridge to the other side. Right? So encouraging people not to shut their wallets, not to shelve their plans, but to keep spending, right, as a way of trying to prevent the state from having to fill that gap in other ways. That involved the bank giving this type of guidance. The alternative of saying nothing, and again, this is another matter which is often discussed at the board level, as you would expect. People don't interpret silence as conveying no information, right? On the contrary. So the bank, we often discuss whether what we should say anything at all, and if so, what we should say, in order to try to encourage confidence as far as we can, right? Now, that's a tricky business, as you would appreciate. Just to swing across to stability for a moment here, Chris, and picking your point up, Greg, that is why the Treasurer of the Commonwealth, right, as advised by the Governor of the Central Bank, who happens to be the Chairman of the Council of Financial Regulators, right, made a comment the other day about the soundness of the Australian banking system. Now, that's forward guidance, brother. That's exactly what that is, right? Don't run on the Australian banks. You don't need to do that. Why not? Because they are sound. turn off the television and watching what you're seeing happening in Europe and the United States. That's forward guidance. And why would the Treasurer do that in the public interest?
But I think that highlights. I think that highlights like a sense in which it isn't that like the forward guidance of the RBA during this episode is distinct, which is the appearance of specific numerical aspects to that guidance, right? And I think that's where. So if the RBA had simply said in 2020 we are going to keep the cash rate low for an extended period of time, at, you know, when circumstances start to change, if inflation starts to pick up or other signs of recovery start to pick up, then we will kind of revisit our kind of commitment to...
And that's, in effect, really, what we started off saying.
Yeah.
And then the sort of the clamouring kept coming and, well, how long is that? And our forecasts, everyone was at sea on forecasting by now, of course. And so, basically... What you said was exactly where we started, and then what crept in was, and we don't expect that'll be to about 2024. Yeah. That was how the whole thing played out, and that was I think where we slipped, and I think we acknowledged in our review of forward guidance that we erred, we didn't do great on that. But to Ian's point about forward guidance. The Fed dot plots are all forward guidance.
Yeah.
I mean, central banks around the world use forward guidance, and they have used forward guidance in the past.
Sure, of course.
And some of them use time-based, so the Fed dot plots are all time-based. So forward guidance is all around. Having said that, I think we don't feel that we would be heading back in a hurry to time-based, any sort of time forward guidance. I think our more usual practice is much more qualitative. The conditions that we would want to see before we move interest rates, you know. So I think we have learnt something from that episode that we'll take forward with us.
I want to kind of start talking about, our more recent experiences. But before I do, I just want to touch on something that was sort of brought up in passing, which was the yield curve control experiment. So, Begonia, I was going to ask you about whether you think in the future the yield curve control is something that should still be on the table, or whether the end of essentially the run at the end is something that's damning of the experience.
Going back to what Greg said about forward guidance, I think actually there is more effect of forward guidance in the real economy than the yield control. It seems to me that there is very little, not clear evidence of what the effect of that yield control has on the economy. And at the end of the day, businesses and households in Australia, they had plenty of liquidity, so it's not that they were providing liquidity. It seems it was mostly driven due to the 3-year mortgage fixed term in Australia. I haven't written up a model and evaluated how much of that has played into the economy. I'm not sure we should start using this anytime soon.
Michelle, I'll ask you then, how do you think about it in retrospect?
Well, in retrospect, I mean, again, we've done a review of this, and it worked really well until it didn't.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm asking. So all things considered.
So all things considered, I think... since then, I think we did that first.
Can I say, for the purpose of the audience, when you say it worked well, maybe you should just elaborate what the objective was.
As I said earlier, it was part of a package. So we had a very low interest rate. We had a term funding facility that was extending funding to financial institutions out for 3 years. And this was another way of getting the short end of the yield curve down.
Right.
At a low rate to, again, lower funding costs across that front end of the yield curve. And as you highlighted, it actually did find its way into the economy because it found its way into all of those very low fixed rate mortgages, which we're coming back to.
But
you know, a lot of people, 40% of loans ended up being on these very low fixed term mortgages. So people took advantage of it.
Yeah.
and it was really and it was really that's right. So it's not the US, but nevertheless, that was the purpose, to get that front end of the yield curve down. What I mean when I say it was successful was, while it was credible, we didn't actually have to spend much money defending it.
No.
Because everyone just believed us.
Well, that's the nature of predicting interest.
You know, so it was. Sorry?
But the effect on the balance sheet was huge.
The bond purchase program, the effect on the effect on the bank's balance sheet came from the bond purchase program. So we had the yield curve. The bond purchase program was rolled out subsequently when we thought we needed to get them down at the longer end. So that was more aimed at the 10-year sort of end, but the longer end of the yield curve. And that had that's the one that's had the really big impact on the balance sheet. That's the $200 to $300 billion worth of bonds.
Prices have fallen.
And that's one that's left us in negative equity. The purchases under the yield curve target were actually pretty small, because, as I said, while it was credible, you didn't have to spend a lot of money defending it, and it only got towards the end where I think we called it in the review a disorderly exit from the program that we were actually spending money. But the bulk of it was the bond purchase program. Now, would we do it again? I think our general view is that it's not that flexible and it's hard to get out of. And Japan has still got one, by the way.
Mm.
The Japanese have still got a bond target, yield curve target on the 10-year bond. So it's not easy to get out of. So I think our feeling is that we would lean more towards, even though the financial risks are more with the bond purchase program, it's more flexible because you can dial it up, you can dial it down a bit. You're not aiming at a particular yield. You're aiming at quantities. So I think that would be the way we would think about it into the future.
Very good. Well, I want to sort of transition a little bit more to like contemporary, so to speak, as a contemporary policy issue. I'm going to start by picking up on this idea that in sort of inflation is a transitory kind of coming from the supply side. There's a view that was kind of prevailing sort of 12 to 18 months ago, certainly in certain circumstances. And I'm going to ask Ian, I think a lot of people outside of central banking circles or outside of macro sort of policy circles maybe struggle to understand the role that monetary policy might have in dealing with sort of supply shocks, let's call them. So how should we think about the role of monetary policy in that circumstance? And are there other tools that we could be bringing or should be thinking about if supply sort of shocks are kind of the dominant or like the, you know, like playing a significant role in our current inflationary episode?
Sure. No, thanks, Chris. Well, those people would be right to struggle with that, right?
Okay.
Thinking, so this is a supply-side problem, so why are we trying to deal with that with a demand-side instrument? The fact is, as the aggregate supply curve shifts off to the left, if you've got a reduced aggregate supply for whatever reason, then you've got to make aggregate demand match that, or else the outcome is inflationary. And so you end up dealing with a supply-side problem by managing aggregate demand in order to try to bring the two back together again. Now, this is against the backdrop of an environment in which aggregate demand had been deliberately expanded to deal with what we thought was the opposite problem, right, i.e. a collapse of aggregate demand. So two things happened. Firstly, the aggregate demand didn't collapse as much as we thought, so the stimulus arguably is too much. And now you've got the aggregate supply curve shifting off to the left and doing its own work. So you've got two reasons to try to bring aggregate demand under control quickly. And that's precisely what central banks have done.
So should we be thinking, is there a role for like other instruments? So Greg,
maybe just to dovetail on that, how I think about this. A supply shock is a reduction in real wages. If we think that nominal wages can't fall, then the way that might be realized is an increase in prices.
Mm.
That doesn't necessarily mean an increase in sustained inflation. I think part of the role of the central bank is the one that you were describing earlier, Ian, which is about coordinating expectations, about coordinating multiplicity. So you gave the bank run example. Bank run is a really good example. I don't really think of that as forward guidance. I think of that as the role of as playing a big player of coordinating expectations, coordinating belief. And I think bank has a role to play in coordinating beliefs about what the future path of that required increase in prices is going to be. And so we don't fall into a trap of a wage price spiral and we end up somewhere where we have persistently more inflation than we need.
This idea of having to bring demand back, I must admit I don't quite understand it. If there's a shock to the real side of the economy and it requires a fall in the real wage to bring us back to equilibrium, then that is the real equilibrium. If there's demand was high in the past because the government, the fiscal side, really expanded, it doesn't really make sense to me that then the central bank should be pushing back on that. That seems to be a separate issue. But
I think there's a...
I was just going to say, I think there's a distinction here between an ongoing inflation and a rise in the price.
Correct. Yeah.
What
correct.
You're talking about is the need for the price level to adjust.
Yep.
And what... That's right. And what Ian is talking about is how do we make sure that it's a price level adjustment
and not
ongoing
correct.
Inflation. So I sort of said that it's...
Yeah, and exactly. So one thing you're keeping a weather eye on throughout this process, and including now, is what the markets think the long-term expected inflation rate will be, right? And in our case, throughout this whole experience, the market has said that the long-term, 10-year, expected rate of inflation in this country is 2.5%, right in the middle of the bank's range throughout, right? And that, for me as a board director, is one of the key charts that's presented every month, is to watch that like a hawk. Now, part of the demand response that looks like it's a bit odd when you've got a supply-side problem is to switch off one channel by which that long-term expectation could escape, right? Okay, by giving people the impression, not just that you had monetary policy too loose for so long, and just flipping back to the earlier conversation, as you rightly remember, Greg, lots of people were saying to me at that time, even though interest rates were very low, you wouldn't dare put them lower. You're just putting more fuel on the fire that one day will come. Right?
So again, mentioning what were the long-term rates at that time when long-term inflation expectations at that time when inflation...
Oh, well, at one stage, you know, that this government, our government, could borrow for 30 years at less than 100 basis points. And did. Briefly, right? But they locked stuff in, right, for 30 years. And bluntly, this university has borrowed for 30 years, right, at less than 100 basis points. So a lot of people, not just mortgage holders, did very well out of that. But throughout that process, the expected rate of inflation, you ask people in the street, but some of them would say exactly the same thing, but park that to one side. Ask the markets. People have got money on it, right? And they'd say 2.5%. Now, that's not true in the United States, right? So in the US, it's still the case that the market thinks inflation is going to be higher than the central bank's target. That's not true in Australia. And part of the reason for that, I believe, is that we responded with demand, right, side management, over against a supply-side problem to deal with that issue. Well, amongst others.
I'd add another part of that has got to do with our very different fiscal, long-term fiscal position in Australia relative to the United States.
You mean a structural deficit?
Yes.
But a much smaller one relative to the size.
Oh, I beg your pardon. Sure. So the chances of someone having to monetize it are much lower.
Exactly. Or a significant monetizer.
Yep, quite. I accept that.
So looking in the background here, I kind of... wanted to talk about like the kind of the current pause in the increase in the cash rate and like some of the circumstances around that. So I guess sort of a month ago, we had kind of the failure of Silicon Valley Bank and kind of other kind of financial market disturbances. And so I guess like lurking behind that pause and some of the related discussion in central banks around the world is the ongoing sort of tension between inflation control and financial stability concerns. And so I guess I'm going to ask you, Begonia, like, you know, is that something that we should be concerned about? That is there, like, in crude terms, is there a trade-off between financial stability concerns and inflation control? Should we can put it even cruder? Should the RBA have paused the increase in interest rates?
For the RBA specifically, I would say no. I think, well, first of all, in general, I would say no, because central banks and countries have different instruments to deal with each of them. For the case of Australia specifically, we have APRA, and my understanding is that the standards of APRA are very strong in terms of capital requirements, and not only that, it seems that I didn't know this, but it seems that Australia is one of the only country that has these
interest rate risk in the banking book.
Yeah, which means that they require banks to hold additional capital requirement to hedge against the risk of interest rates going up, which means that actually for Australia there is very little trade-off between the two objectives. Having said that, there is a caution to be made for the US and Europe, because it seems that many commercial banks have been buying all those bonds, and now they have many, like
you have read the news,
they have many losses, unrealized losses. And I read in the news that it seems that the
Federal Deposit Insurance.
In February, they said that there were $620 billion unrealized losses in the U.S. So it's clear that if you have this cycle of monetary policy tightening, that that's going to bring some banks or some banks down. Why did they take so much risk, these banks? It seems that actually there may be some reasons for that. Maybe it could be mismanagement, which seems to be the case for Silicon Valley, but it seems that there are also some reasons. There, I found this paper by Ditella and
Curlett,
that they found that it may be optimal for banks to actually take some of this risk to hedge against the deposit risk, so that, but actually, I mean, there needs to be a bit of a balance there, and it seems some banks went over this. Having said that, still the US and Europe, they have ways of dealing with these situations through appropriate capital requirements, monitoring the banks, and managing this risk. And as long as they keep it managed, which is the case now, I think they should focus on bringing the inflation down, not...
So I'll ask Michelle the same question, but in a slightly different way. So do you think that absent the kind of, you know, failure of Silicon Valley Bank and sort of the related events a month ago, that the bank would have paused?
Yes, and we'd already, even before the problems with Silicon Valley Bank, and we had already suggested that we were thinking about pausing, because we'd moved 350 basis points, 3.5 percentage points in quick time. Mm-hmm. Normally we don't. In fact, in other tightening cycles, we typically move a bit and then we stop and watch and we move a bit. But we had to get from emergency low levels, remove all of that stimulus, and get into restrictive territory. Now, I think what we observed was that we feel we are in restrictive territory because we're starting to see signs on the housing market, consumption, these sorts of things, retail sales. Now just stop for a minute and watch, because we are, you know, the governor uses this term. He's got great terms, doesn't he? The narrow path. He likes the narrow path, you know. So to your point earlier, it would be ideal if we could get inflation down but keep as many of the gains on employment that we have managed to get through this period, you know. So I would say yes, that was always on the cards. The other point I would make is that if you read the statements in fact, the Fed and the ECB continued to increase interest rates even though this had happened. Now, and they both made the point that financial stability concerns can be managed with other
instruments.
They don't have to do it with interest rates.
Yeah.
Having said that, what is likely happening over there at the moment is financial conditions more generally are tightening.
Yeah.
People are running to sort of safer assets. The banks are pulling in their horns a little bit. So that's going to be a factor. It's not saying that the Fed is not increasing as quickly because of the financial stability concerns. It's saying they're taking into account the fact that financial conditions have tightened and therefore they have to maybe do a little bit less.
Yeah.
So that's the perspective I would give on that. The other point, not to labour on too much about it, but we did write about this in our recent financial stability review, a little advertisement for you all if you haven't read it, great read. And we set out what we know about Silicon Valley Bank and the particular issues in those banks in the US. The US has bank failures on a regular basis. They have lots and lots of banks, thousands of them, and some of the smaller ones are failing all of the time.
Yeah, but they don't resolve them through emergency FDIC measures.
No, because
the 12th largest one.
This one was a large one of the small ones, but it had, and the ones around it that were particularly at risk had these particular characteristics. One was they had a lot of bonds sitting with unrealized losses on their balance.
Unhedged.
Two, they had concentrated deposit bases, concentrated in two ways, large amounts of money by a small amount of people, and also the types of people. They were all tech people.
Mm.
And so...
It's easier to run.
Absolutely.
And some of the feedback you get from when we listen to regulators around the world talk about this, so they have never seen a run so quick. It was basically a quarter of deposits in, because they're uninsured.
The size of
it. So there was the size and the speed of the run had just never been seen before.
Yeah.
So that's why the regulators had to step in.
Stand outside in the cold.
Yeah. Sorry.
No. I mean, I think we can all understand that there are kind of like well-founded reasons why. One, there was special authority was granted for the FDIC to intervene, and in a situation where at face value they may not have. But I'm more kind of interested in this issue of the interaction of these sort of mechanisms with monetary policy, and whether so you kind of gave a fairly kind of direct statement that you think that like conditions are tightening in Australia and
I would say overseas they are tightening. Sorry if I misinterpreted.
That's what I wanted to ask about.
No, in Australia we are actually not seeing signs of financial tightening here. There is the banks here. Pagonia already highlighted the way that they're very, very well regulated here. Interest rate risk in the banking book meant that they have to hold capital as the prices if they're not hedged. And in fact, what they do is they do hedge because they do know that they don't have to hold capital if they're not hedged against these sorts of things. So there's no doubt that the banks are very solid here. There's no sign that there's any tightening in financial conditions because people are worried about the banks or runs on the banks. And as yet, there doesn't seem to be the Australian banks reacting in any way to tighten financial conditions either. So no, I would say that's not an issue.
Okay, I'm glad you clarified that. So because I was going to ask Greg, so like, do you think then that it was correct to kind of like to pause in this sort of most recent sort of decision, or whether whether we should have been continuing to kind of tighten given that inflation continues to be significantly in excess of target?
Look, I think the more important question is where are we going, and how are we going to get there? My view is the difference between 25 basis points now or in 3 months' time. There's over the sort of periods that we think that the central bank really can control inflation is probably neither here or there. It's more understanding what our members of the board here are thinking about in terms of what they're keeping their eye on. I think Ian nailed it on the head when he said we're keeping our eye on what that those long-term inflation expectations are, and I feel quite comfortable as long as those are being kept under control, because at the end of the day, that's what we want to make sure, that these temporary shocks that we've been hit with don't translate into persistently higher inflation.
I think that's fair enough, I think, at one level. But on another level, that's sort of like a rationale for not doing anything this month and then next month. Like, it can take so at what point does that argument sort of strain credulity in the sense that, like... just to kind of like
now and when it doesn't. I mean,
well, let me put it like exactly. That's very useful. Yeah. So let me kind of make this a little bit more concrete. One might think that once you see those measures of market inflation expectations start to move significantly to the point where you would then change the actions that you would otherwise have taken, that in some sense you're
too late. Maybe.
And so then the question is like, ex ante, what should we be doing? So just let me make this really concrete. Let's suppose that you were never going to see, along the equilibrium path, if you'll excuse the expression, a kind of a change in inflation expectations, right? So the question is like, ex ante, what kinds of developments would lead you to change your monetary policy actions? supposing that, you know, that if you did things correctly, right, in rational expectations equilibrium, you would never see those inflation expectations change.
Well, I'm just going to say the obvious, I think, which is that we're going to look at the signals that we see in the world that give us some confidence that the mechanisms by which we think we can impact inflation are actually starting to play out. Now, in the model that you described, that you never see that because it doesn't happen. Fortunately, we don't live in that model. But in that model, we also know ex ante exactly how much inflation we would see from a particular shock. So we saw the big issuance of nominal liabilities. We saw a temporary supply shock. In that model, we know exactly what to do. Fortunately, we're not in that model because we don't see that. But we have a lot of things that we can be looking at, and we want to be seeing turning points in this. And I suspect that's what goes on at the board level and what I see in the communications, that we're starting to see some pressures on wages.
So you think that we've seen enough of a turning point, like just to kind of come, so you junk all the equilibrium talk and to say, so we've seen enough of a turning point, you think, that it's like a pause is sort of fully warranted?
Well, I'm not going to add to what the Deputy Governor said about that. The minutes haven't even been released, right? The minutes of the previous meeting, right, as she rightly pointed out, spoke about a pause as one of the scenarios or one of the recommendations that was put alongside another recommendation, which is that we go with another 25 basis points. And as it turned out, the board went with the 25 basis points. So the pause proposition had come up well before any bank failures. And in this discussion, well, I think I really you can read the minutes when they're released.
But I mean, I think an important, obviously I'm not privy to the minutes, so I can, I can speak freely and nothing I say has any weight to it. But it is the point that, expectations don't move that fast. Now, it is true that...
Until they do,
but, you know, the idea that realized inflation is...
But this is the peso problem or the fixed exchange rate problem, all of these things, right? Oh. Like, so we have very recent dramatic examples of that they don't move until they do.
Yeah, in currency markets, yes. And
yield curve markets.
And yield curve markets, well, sure.
That's 3 years, yeah.
But, I mean, in real goods, in the trade for goods and labor, no. In fact, it's the opposite. Things take really, really long time to
I mean, the point is...
So we're going to get a lot of warning there.
Yeah. I mean, the point really is, yes, it's comforting to see that long-term inflationary expectations are anchored.
Yes.
But I tend to agree that if you saw... It'd be too late. If you saw them shoot up, it's almost too late.
So. Well, to the point that they stayed constant throughout the episode, right? Mm. So if you just thought that's the only thing to worry about, you would neither have relaxed monetary policy nor tightened monetary policy. You'd just sit there, right? Which nobody's going to do.
So you are back to looking at, if you think we have an excess demand problem and we're trying to wind it back, you end up looking for the signs that you're seeing it come through in demand, the sorts of things that we're looking at. And we're also looking at, obviously, inflation itself.
Yeah. And look, I mean, the bank has moved you, what was it, 375 basis points? 350 basis points? That's a big movement. I've been out on the record saying that I don't think 25 basis points movements here or there actually do anything. And, you know...
But they add up.
Exactly. So that's exactly right. And I often get criticized for saying, oh, so you don't think monetary policy has an effect?
No,
I didn't say that. I just said, it doesn't really matter if we're 25 here or a bit later or a bit like that. The reality is, it's probably not going to matter. There's no people out in the street who really is going to make that much of a difference to. But it will add up and it will accumulate. And that has to, so you're asking, is the pause? Well, I don't know, but.
The only thing is that once you pause, when do you go up?
But the history...
You can do it.
The history shows that that's exactly what we...
That's right. When the facts change, you change your mind.
Pausing is more common rather than not.
Well, pausing in the past has been more common. This one where we've done it at every single meeting is actually the exception.
It's more the pause... Let me kind of...
But it's almost
more
like
the pause.
It's almost like you're looking for an algorithm. And how do we do it? Like, I think this line of reasoning is in want of an algorithm that says, here are the inputs into our reaction function, and that will spit out what we do. And I suspect that's going to be really difficult to articulate. But
I'll put the point slightly differently. So it's more like pause relative to, like, other major central banks. Right? So that's, I think, a sort of... And so, like, we're seeing the dollar depreciate significantly. Yep. Like, we might
Significantly?
Well, 66.
No,
the level.
No, we haven't seen it.
It's
the level is like
it's basically on a
TWI basis. It's rock solid.
More important. Yeah. Yeah. It's rock solid.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So it's for whatever reason, the market path in Australia for interest rates, for official interest rates, is lower than it is overseas. Yes. Now, partly that's reflected in wages increasing more sharply overseas, particularly in places like the UK, New Zealand, US. So it might partly be reflecting that. But that's what we're seeing in the markets. And that's, as Ian said, they're the people putting their money on it. So.
Very good. All right. Well, I'm going to switch gears a little bit to kind of more institutional questions more broadly understood. So, and we've already touched on like the interactions between monetary and fiscal policy. So I'm going to kind of advance a thesis statement and like invite people to kind of comment on it. So I'm going to basically make the claim that monetary and fiscal policy can't be thought of as being functionally independent in the sense that the path of fiscal policy matters for monetary policy and the path of monetary policy matters for fiscal policy. We have an institutional setting where it's very difficult to comment in what I'll call a mature way about the interactions between monetary and fiscal policy without kind of creating sort of, you know, a lot of noise. But it seems somehow undesirable that we can't talk about in a kind of an open way about the implications of the stance of monetary policy for fiscal policy, especially issues of like long-run fiscal policy. And we can't talk about the implications of fiscal policy for monetary policy, especially short-run monetary policy. So are there things that could be done to allow that conversation to take place in a kind of more constructive way? Or do you disagree with the premise? Like, you can just say, I don't agree.
The way I'm not sure I agree entirely with the premise. The way I would think about it is that fiscal policy needs to basically, it needs to go into deficit when it's needed for purposes of supporting the economy, and then we need to be able to make that back. So obviously it needs to move with the cycle, and it has a structural element to it, and the government's got to figure out ways to pay for services that it wants to offer to all of us Australians, and that involves them making hard choices about taxes and debt and those sorts of things. Monetary policy is much more a cyclical thing, and I see it much more as fiscal policy. It's difficult if fiscal policy is working completely at odds with monetary policy. You saw that in the UK when the government tried to expand fiscal policy markedly while the Bank of England was trying to fight inflation. The markets did not react very well to that. So there is a sense in which fiscal policy and monetary policy need to be pulling together, but I do think that one is much more structural and the other one is much more cyclical.
Having said that, there's a strong cyclical element given the automatic stabilisers and fiscal policy, and at the moment those automatic stabilisers are working very much in sync with monetary tightening.
Yeah, they are.
So the budget that the Treasurer will announce next month is likely to look a whole lot more in the black than people are expecting off the back of the result of cyclical tightening.
But let me just kind of push that. But if next budget is unexpectedly not as constrictive as currently expected, if there is sort of surprise spending or surprise tax initiatives, then that is going to matter for like the operations of monetary policy over the next year.
The extent it adds to demand
exactly.
in the economy, the extent it's got excess demand, then it does matter, yes.
And you won't be able to say a single thing about it.
No, that's not true, I think.
The governor is often,
He's often talked about.
To the extent of being criticised for making comments about.
Well, no, because then it was kind of construed in these much less direct terms, right? So it would be good if we had, faster way. I'm thinking back to 2018, 2019. It would be good if we had faster wage growth in the public sector and things like that, which you construe as relating to fiscal policy broadly speaking, but is sort of I think you was more narrowly about like the monetary policy transmission mechanism and like where do we think nominal wage growth comes from. But anyway, I want to hear you.
I was going to say one more thing about that. The other structural element, and as you're aware in comments that people have been making in advance of the review of the Reserve Bank that's yet to be released, people have said that it's a problem for us that the Treasury Secretary is a member of the board of the bank. And I would say that even though the Treasury Secretary is there, that officer is not there to represent the government. That officer is there, in this case, his own capacity as an economist. But that doesn't mean that the Treasury Secretary can't inform the board about thinking with respect to fiscal policy, and does. Right? So right in the room there, with one vote of nine, is a person whose day job is setting, or at least advising the government, on how fiscal policy should be set. And if we have questions about how that might, you know, feed into the decision the board is currently discussing, there's the person right there.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone is very conscious of that. And if you think back when we're talking earlier about having inflation below target and the challenges of getting it up to target prior to the pandemic, one of the things that was going on at the same time as we were lowering interest rates was the government was tightening fiscal policy as well.
Yes.
So it was working sort of a little bit against it.
I agree, and that's the kind of episode that's kind of guiding my question, where I feel like commentary about the extent to which fiscal policy was unnecessarily, you know, contractionary in that episode was quite muted, I would say, relative to the fundamentals. Mm-hmm. Now, you might say, well, if you listened carefully to the right people in the right places, then you would hear it.
Yeah. But isn't that the idea? At the end of the day, central banks can set interest rates independently of what's happening.
So, fiscal instrument dependence as opposed to policy.
Yeah. Fiscal policy can issue nominal liabilities and raise real surpluses or run real deficits.
Independently of monetary policy.
Independently of what's happening. The fact that there is an objective of the central bank that says you have to target inflation, and the reality is, whether we like it or not, that the outcome of inflation is a result of the combination of both what the fiscal authority and monetary authority do.
Doing, yeah.
That's neither here nor there. The central bank can still comment on, well, we have to target inflation, and given the fiscal environment, this is what we're going to do. Mm. I mean, there's nothing stopping the Treasury saying, well, given what the RBA is doing, this is what we're going to do. It turns out that the Stackelberg game normally works the other way, with the fiscal authority moving first and the central bank reacting to it. I don't think that's legislated, though, that it has to be that way.
No, but it's fiscal policy typically moves slightly slower than monetary policy.
That's the other thing.
But also the rules of the game are different, no? As you said, the RBA has mandate, while the fiscal authority doesn't have. It's more prone to discretionary choices. But I think there is a need for improving the coordination. I'm glad to hear that there is this information going through. I'm not sure there should be a representative of the Treasury in the board. That's mixing things. But at a minimum, it's needed to have that information going on. Together with my co-author Pedro, he's going to be presenting a paper tomorrow in which we see that the way central banks need to respond depend on what is the fiscal stand. But not only that, I think to improve the coordination, we would need to have kind of some mandates also for fiscal policy to have some. We have to acknowledge that fiscal and monetary policies are very different. We can more or less agree that inflation is a bad thing, high inflation, all of us. But if we start talking about what is the optimal size of the government, we might disagree very much. And however, even if we disagree on that, we could agree on certain principles of efficiency or transparency and accountability. And all these things would help that coordination to work in a better way. And recently, Professor Eric Lipper from Virginia, he has been talking about the importance of transparency from fiscal policy. Like, we have been talking about forward guidance, but kind of like also that kind of forward guidance to be also on the fiscal side, so that that helps anchor expectations of fiscal policy. And that would help your job and to understand what is going to go.
There's sort of a little bit of that, isn't there, though, because the when you do the budget, they do forecast forward,
yeah,
and they
the
do
forward estimates.
Forward estimates, and they, yes, there's some assumptions in there and so on, but they do a little bit of that.
So more than it used to be.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, it's moving that way.
So I'm just going to, so I think we've had a kind of a good discussion to like seed the terrain, so to speak, but what I'm going to do now is like throw the floor open to kind of questions from the audience. So we've got about half an hour left, and so if you can just put your hand up and we'll kind of take questions as it comes. To Kevin.
Kevin, it's probably a quarter of a century since I really focused on Russian bots. But reflecting that, I mean, the four words were very important or very common.
Long impact.
And they're related to this issue of the dates that things are going to happen. And that was long and very
yes.
And I wonder whether the thinking on that has changed. And the second one was, Michelle, you said we're in the unknown. I think back to the early 1970s, supply shock and so on. Is there anything that can be merged from that as relevant to now?
Long and variable lags, yes, it's a term that's certainly back in fashion. I think we still, and that's another reason for pausing, basically, is you know, we've done in 10 months, 11 months, we've done 3.5 percentage points. So, yes, we're waiting now to see how long it takes the lags to come through. One of the things that's been interesting about this particular episode is that 40% of people are on fixed rate mortgages. So it's coming through slower into the cash flows of households than it has done in the past. So that's another reason why the lags might be slightly more long and variable than they might otherwise have been. So another reason for the pause. The lesson I would take away from the earlier 70s episodes is you cannot let inflationary expectations get out of control. And I think that's all the more reason why interest rates actually at 3.5% and the official cash rate, they're still not that high relative to history.
I agree. That's right.
So I think we've just got to keep in mind that, yes, they've gone up quickly. Yes, some people are hurting, but it's not the whole population. There's other things going on here as well. And I think we just have to keep in mind that the lesson for me at least is inflationary expectations need to be kept under control. So we've got to keep an eye on the long term, but we've got to make sure that we are observing what's going to bring aggregate demand back. So that's for me the lesson.
Can I add one what we can learn from the 70s?
Yeah.
So we raised interest rates by a lot more in the 70s.
No, yeah.
So it was very, very clear that eventually, but we got to a point where real rates were undoubtedly positive at all horizons.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, that's clear.
So now we have to look out quite a long way to get to those inflation expectations to get to a world of positive real rates. But I think there's something positive to take from the 70s in the Australian context, which is there was also a lot of fiscal coordination at that point. If you look at what happened ex post in terms of fiscal policy, is that over the coming decades after that, return to surplus. And in the United States as well. But now here, what you were talking about earlier about, we're in a much better position than a lot of other countries. And I think that's another argument for the pause, is that when we think about what we're going to see on the fiscal side, is that that played a big role in the 70s, and we're more likely to see that playing a role, I think, in Australia than in other countries.
Yeah.
So I think you might have an easier job than...
Yeah. Just one more on the 70s, Mark. We've been
critical.
Yeah, I do remember the 70s, Kevin, just like you.
I just read about it.
And we have been criticised, right, the governor's been criticised in talking about the risk of a prices wages outbreak, right, of thinking, quote unquote, in 1970s terms, right? In other words, people referring to the fact that back then there was a much higher degree of unionisation, much greater centralisation of wage fixing, and therefore the chances of, I mean, during the 1970s we had actual indexation, if you'll recall, right? Well, literally wages were indexed to prices. So it is true when the ACTU, our union big body, and others make the point that that's all outdated thinking. Doesn't mean that there won't be a prices wages spiral, but not for that reason, right? So we've learned from that, I think, Kevin. Just to your point briefly there, Greg, of course, in the 1970s, the exchange rate wasn't floating, yeah, right? So we didn't really have an independent monetary policy. That's one way to get fiscal monetary coordination. Yeah. You just don't have an independent monetary policy.
So there were a few questions here.
Sent back to the fiscal authorities, right? At some point, it gets noticed, and it's going to have a, at least in the US, there's an impact, right? So, yeah. So in terms of monetary policy going forward, but now it's, you've got these huge expansions of the balance sheets. So, thoughts about that relative to sort of what we learned about dealing with inflation and handling inflation in the 1990s, right, versus now, right? The big difference is the balance sheet.
Well, the balance sheet is certainly different. If I could make the point in our case that the central bank's balance sheet is marked to market. So we know exactly what the losses are. We know exactly how much we're underwater with capital. And there was a discussion at the board as to whether we should ask the government to recapitalize the bank or whether, you're right, Ask the government whether they should recapitalize the bank or whether we would just carry this loss, because after all, it's, you know, it disappears into the public sector in the wider scheme of things, and work it off as the bonds mature, because it's a mark-to-market loss. We will still lose, but the loss won't be as great as we approach the maturity date for these different bonds, right? It'll come good. And the result of that conversation between the bank and the government was that, no, we would just carry it. It'll be announced in the annual report. People all know about it. I don't think that that's made any difference to the effectiveness that the bank has in terms of its monetary policy. It's public information. The reason that it's occurred is completely understood. The alternative would have been, as has happened once before, for the government to recapitalize the bank and to realize the loss on its own balance sheet straight up. Nobody thought that would make any difference, really. And in respect of the seniorage point that you make, the Treasury is well aware that the government, that the bank, pardon me, will not be paying dividends for the next, what, 5 years, is it? And so they already know and have built that into their estimates that they've got to find that additional money to keep their own accounts in order, because the bank is not paying dividends for 5 years. Hmm. So none of that is a secret. Hmm. Yeah.
I think we had a question here.
Hi, I'm Ed Burton from the University of Virginia. Thanks for the shout out to my colleague, Eric Leeper. The Federal Reserve, I'm not that familiar with Australian banking or New Zealand banking, but the Federal Reserve system has been criticized quite a bit for its targeting policies. It was criticized for targeting rates to be, overnight rates to be too low for a long period of time. And now there's a huge chorus from many directions that they've stayed the course too long on targeting rates at higher levels. And the question is, what you always have to wonder what might have happened in the absence of some of these policies. And the question I'd like to ask is, if on March 15th, 2022, the Federal Reserve had, I can just imagine Jay Powell coming out and saying, we're announcing today we're no longer going to target the overnight rates. We're going to let them just go wherever they want, but without changing the planned reduction in the Federal Reserve balance sheet. What then might have happened? It strikes me as unlikely that rates would have stayed low with inflation clipping along at about 6% pace. So how much different would the pattern of rates have been had the Fed simply abandoned rate targeting in March of 2022?
Can I just ask a clarification, because I'm not sure I fully understood? And did what instead?
Yeah.
Just shrunk the balance. Mm-hmm.
Continued the balance sheet reduction plan that they had announced in December. Suppose they simply left that in place.
The bonds mature.
I see.
They don't buy any additional bonds back.
So they basically run down liquidity.
They just run down liquidity. Okay.
Exactly. They just let the balance sheet.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really know the answer to that question, I have to say. I mean, we do know that in the past, post-GFC, when they ran down their balance sheet, it did get to a point where the markets did, in fact, tighten quite significantly in the taper tantrum, for example. So I guess my question back to you is whether or not that would just result in a lot more volatility, which would be unhelpful, rather than the more stable process of saying, well, we're going to control the rate and we'll move it up in a controlled fashion, rather than just running down the balance sheet and having volatility in rates, which might be very unhelpful.
I actually have a paper also with Pedro on how to manage the balance sheet. And one thing that we learned is that it's good to do these things slowly so that to keep the economy stable. I'm not sure about doing something quite different on when you are in the middle of all those bad shocks happening in the economy. I'm not sure if that would add more volatility to the. I would be concerned with that. One thing that is different nowadays compared to the 70s is that actually we have central bankers that know much better how to do the job, and that needs the 70s. So is to throw everything out of the window, and I wouldn't do that in the middle of a crisis.
Respond to David.
So I think the rates were moved 11 times or 10 times in a row. So my question is about credibility of the Reserve Bank. Like, yes, there was a message that till 2024 rates will not go up and people make investment decisions on that. And another question is about countries in the central bank would hold bonds as well of the foreign currency. And especially USD bonds have gone down, and now they are investing in gold, and gold prices are shooting up. So in future, if there is another way around where Reserve Bank wants people to spend money and they're lowering interest rate, why would people trust that that will stay in a foreseeable future and really spend money rather than paying off their mortgages?
Well, I think, and we concluded this in our review of forward guidance, that actually our credibility, we think, did in fact suffer through this process. So I think you're right. But if we were lowering rates in the future, I don't think we'd be giving forward guidance in the same manner that we have given it in this emergency situation. So I think people would be responding based on their classic decisions about intertemporal substitution. Do they want to save? Do they want to? And we do know, one thing we do know is that Australians do like to save. They do like to sock money away into their offset and redraw accounts.
Even
when rates are going up, and they're still doing it. I think the credibility issue is a good point.
Everyone up.
given that we're in a post-COVID world, I'm curious about the learnings from that event. So I think we faced a pretty unique situation where there was uneven impact on certain job sectors versus not. And my understanding of monetary policy is that's relatively broad brush. And so in future now, when you're dealing with targeted interventions, do you have a better method of dealing with this? Or are you coordinating with the government better on fiscal policy, for example, or the new methods developed? I'm just curious what's been learned in that situation.
Well, I'll start, and Ian, you might have a view. We've discussed this before. We've got one. I mean, despite the fact that we've used these other policies, we've really got one instrument, and that's the interest rate. And yes, it is. It's blunt. That's the other word that comes up a lot. Long and variable lags. Interest rate use is blunt. It affects different people differently. And what we're hearing a lot about now is the people that it's squeezing, which are the people that have mortgages. That's the one third of the population. There's two thirds of the population that don't have mortgages, and quite a few of them are seeing the interest rates rise on their deposit accounts. So there's different. So I guess I would say that, you know, heaven forbid we ended up in some sort of situation like this again. I think we'd probably, and this again was one of the findings out of the review, was that we insured really heavily for the downside risk. We threw everything at it because we're really worried about the downside risk. Maybe in retrospect, going forward, we might want to do a little bit more thinking about what if we're wrong on the upside and how bad could it be. So I think that would probably be the main learning. But in terms of the interest rate, it's what we've got. It's blunt.
Michelle Swathi from Bloomberg News. My question is to either you or Ian on whether there is any nervousness around the housing market, which is rising, and there are some commentators who are calling the trough in the market. So a kind of inflation follow through from housing market. We are seeing rents rising as well and continuing to go up. And a follow through on that is whether you're putting hope over prudence in taking longer to bring down inflation.
You want to have a go at houses? Go at houses. So there's actually so many bits in that question. So the established housing market. It's fallen quite a bit since its peak, but then people forget it went up 20% in the pandemic. It's still above where it was.
Pre-pandemic,
that's right. Interestingly, initially it fell and then it rose very sharply. So it's still above that. It has stabilised. One of the things we do know is that there are wealth effects. People do respond. Consumption does respond when housing prices are falling. It's typically having an impact on the way people are thinking about their wealth and also their consumption. So to the extent it's stabilised, that might indicate that people have sort of stabilised at a lower level of consumption, but they're not falling any further. So that might be one. So we're watching that because of the things that have been turning down. We talked about consumption. We talked about housing prices. The other thing in the established housing market, of course, is that there is quite a big pipeline to be run off from all of the stimulus that went into the housing market through fiscal programs and state government programs. But there's actually quite a big cliff coming. Housing approvals and starts and so on, 6 to 9 months out, are not looking very good at all. So there's a few things in the established housing market. Some suggest maybe things are stabilising, others suggesting no, they're not. The question about rents is a different one. Vacancy rates are really low. They're at historically low levels in many places and they're below average in Sydney and Melbourne. We haven't been building much high density. All of the pandemic spending went into freestanding detached housing. And the other thing that's happened is that household size has declined to historic lows. Through the pandemic, people didn't want to share anymore. They wanted to have a spare office in the house. So So there's a few things going on there. And on top of that, we've got immigration.
Immigration, exactly.
But strong immigration. So, yes, there is trouble brewing in the rental accommodation, and that has implications for inflation because rental inflation is going to rise. So you put all those things together. I'm not sure what sort of pudding you get, but it's complicated. And it means that we have to continue to watch what's going on in the housing market because there's some things that are playing on the downside and there's other things that are actually going to be playing on the upside for inflation. So that's
right.
That's where I'd say we're at with that.
Yep.
Hi, my name is Sydney Levy. I'm an undergraduate student at the University of Virginia, and I just want to thank you all for hosting this panel today. It's been really interesting to be a part of and listen to. So my question is regarding the long-term inflation expectations that you were talking about before. And admittedly, I'm only familiar with the history of inflation expectations in the U.S. And looking at the empirical data, really only in one instance, in I believe 1981, the inflation expectations predicted what inflation did. For basically the entire history of tracking inflation expectations, there's been really no correlation between inflation expectations being able to predict what happens with inflation. Really, it's been, unsurprisingly, the expectations are trailing the actual inflation pattern. So going back to your mention of the importance of looking at inflation expectations before, I would love if you could just elaborate more on that and why that's so important in your determinations of policy.
Well, for me, it feeds into what I think the markets are thinking, right? It is likely to happen, and the impact of that. Now, the fact that they may well be wrong ex post is, you know, I take your point, but what matters is their ex ante expectations, what they're thinking now is likely to happen, how that feeds into the decisions that they're making about buying and selling securities, right, which feeds into prices and interest rates. That's the relevance of that. If the markets started to, if those expectations became unanchored, then people are going to start changing their behavior, right, about how they demand and buy and sell securities, let alone what they buy and sell in the markets. And that changes the response that we have to make at a policy level. All right. So it's really giving you a window on what people who are putting money on the table, what their guesses are about the future. And your valid point is that their guesses, it may just be a random walk. It may just be like throwing a coin or tossing a coin or throwing a die when you look back at it. Right. True. But what matters for us making policy is what we think, right? They think we're going to do, right? So it's a window on their expectations of what they think we're going to do as a policymaker and what the impact of that's likely to be over the long haul.
So what they think is going to happen in the future is always wrong. It never correlates or can predict what will actually
happen.
The question is whether it's systematically wrong.
Yeah.
So
this is on average.
That would be a big problem, and I take your point. I think it's a really good one. If it's systematically the case that expectations undershoot or overshoot realized inflation, then you start to worry about. But
the
if it's just that they're a mean zero.
It's that they follow. So there's no inflation, people don't expect inflation. And then once inflation starts to increase, that's when expectations, they see what's happening, then they expect.
Well, that's okay. What I would worry about is if I could predict inflation on the basis of inflation expectations.
Yeah.
If that were the case, we'd be in trouble. And if that is the case, probably we need to start looking at other data. I don't know whether or not it is. It's still consistent that that's not the case, and they still follow. That's possible as well.
Mm.
There may be also many different forms of expectations of inflation. If you just think about the standard new pension model firms that are setting up prices are going to be thinking about what is going to be the cost of the inputs that they need to buy to produce. And that is going to affect how they are going to be setting prices. So
it's a feedback on behavior.
It's a good point.
I'm going to ask a typical Australian question. I'm Chong Cheng from Monash University. So It's a common fact that both of the economic condition of Australia and the fiscal policy are benefited by the commodity price boom during the 2005 and during the pandemic crisis. And it's likely that the commodity price boom will have to go down in the next 1 year or 2 years, and the Commonwealth Treasury is likely to have a fiscal consolidation. So my question is, will you worry that the current hiking interest rate will lead to a possible economic recessions or a possible economic slowdown in Australia in the next 2 or 3 years, and how the central bank will respond to it?
Because of the commodity price cycle.
Well, I think the question was that the current commodity price cycle is supporting the fiscal position of the government. Is that your point?
Yeah.
And therefore, as that unwinds, then the fiscal position is going to basically wane, and we're going to end up the reverse of the boom from the commodity price will end up with a recession from the commodity price.
So monetary policy would have to be recalibrated.
Monetary policy would have to be recalibrated. The other thing that happens is the exchange rate can move.
A natural edge.
It does tend to, at the moment, commodity prices have risen, but our models suggest that the exchange rate is where it probably should be in terms of commodity prices and interest differentials. It probably looks about right. But one of the other thing that could happen is the exchange rate could fall if you ended up in that position.
Okay. Yes. Thank you very much. My name is Juan. I'm from the University of Technology, Sydney. My question is similar to the one that Chris asked to all of you, and it's about the trade-off. If you see any trade-off between the macroprudential policy and the expansion and contraction of different lending channels in Australia particularly?
Trade-off. I'm not sure I'd use the word trade-off for macroprudential policy. I think the rise of macroprudential policy, I think, has been quite interesting over the last decade or so. It's always been used quite extensively in more developing countries to try and control where lending's going and how it's and lending standards and so on. It's really only, I would say, over the last 5 years, gained much traction in Australia. APRA started to dabble in this about 5 years ago. They've more recently also added a very explicit one now. They're going to have a counter-cyclical capital buffer, so they're going to build it in now rather than just relying on lending standards. But it is, to your point, we talked earlier about the trade-offs between interest rates and the potential impact on financial stability, and this is one way in which APRA has, in the last little while, tried to address some of those financial stability concerns. So we talked about pre-pandemic, when inflation was low, we were trying to lower interest rates a bit further, we were trying to be a bit prudent. The other thing that was happening was APRA was trying to crack down a little bit on lending standards. So they were, in fact, moving into interest-only lending, for example, and saying, well, we'll put limits on that. High LVR lending is another thing. In recent times, they focused on high debt-to-income ratio lending. So there is an increasing push in this, and I think you'll see more of this from APRA, because they've got a framework now that they're working on, and that's not done independently of the bank. Ian mentioned earlier the Council of Financial Regulators. In considering what role macroprudential policy might play in thinking about financial stability concerns, it gets discussed with the bank, it gets discussed in the Council of Financial Regulators. So I wouldn't say it's a trade-off. I'd say it's a part of the package of things that we've got available to manage the economy, and it's getting more legs.
So I think we've got time for one more question. I'm aware there's
someone over here.
Okay, right. Well, let's say two very quick questions.
I agree with you. We definitely should end on time.
Very quick question. This is Raj Banerjee from UniSA. My question is about productivity. So there was a lot of talk previously about how, you know, real wage is not increasing, like whereas the nominal wage is increasing, and then whether labor productivity is actually increasing in that pace or not. So do you, what's your thoughts about that one in the context of Australian situation, post-pandemic times?
Greg. Well, Greg, I think I could say that we're not happy with it.
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Well, look, there's two ways to bring inflation down. Either lower the price of goods in terms of money, or you can raise the price of money in terms of goods, and higher productivity would be the best way out of it for everyone. So that, we don't have to do anything. So that'd
That's
be great.
Right. There's 1,000 pages worth of proposals on the government, on the Treasury.
Yes, exactly. At least.
And over here.
Sorry, my name is Krishna. I've got a very hypothetical question. I'm not a finance student, so I've been just listening to Michelle about when talking about going down to interest rate to 0.1%. What stopped you to go to negative interest rate?
Well, I actually wasn't on the board at the time, Ian might, so that's my out.
That's a good answer to that.
I would say, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ian, that it was considered by the board quite extensively, but it was felt that the potential, it wouldn't give you much, and observing what had happened with negative interest rates in a number of European countries, particularly overseas, potentially quite introduced some quite damaging impacts. So I think the feeling was that the board decided that really it wasn't a path we wanted to necessarily go down. Not ruled out completely, but it was really not a path we wanted to go down, given other experiences.
Yep. Fair summary. Remember that the rate of interest, right, on currency is zero. Okay? And the last thing we wanted was for people to run in favour of currency and out of the banking system. The banks, similarly, wouldn't, or at least, have shown great reluctance to offer negative interest rates on deposits. And so as interest rates go down and down, you narrow bank margins, and you talk about your trade-off with financial stability, the last thing you want is for monetary policy running interest rates at such low levels that you start to compromise the income to the banks.
Okay, income to the banks is a good place to start.
Yeah.
All right, so
I wanted to thank everybody for coming, and also please join me in thanking our esteemed panel of experts for sharing their wisdom. Thank you very much.